As a child, you really think in binaries, right? In either good or bad.
I understood that the body can talk so much about the history.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and this week we're asking the question, how did you get here? And we're listening to the stories and struggles behind the journeys that have brought people to Australia. First up, Selena Shannon brings us the story of Paul, not his real name, a Sydney-based PhD student who had a pretty difficult upbringing in the US.
Have you ever had to live with the consequences of a big decision that you made as a kid? A decision that's ended up changing or redirecting your entire life? Even with good intentions, it's impossible for a kid to understand the magnitude of certain life choices. But what do you do when you start to grow up and that decision that you made as a kid starts to play out in a really big way? It's November 1991 in the US state of Massachusetts, and Paul's family is getting the house ready for Christmas. They have a Christmas tree set up and decorations around the house when, out of the blue, a family comes to their door.
When I was about 6 or 7, Jehovah's Witnesses came and knocked at our door, as they normally do to preach. It was a family, so it was the mother, the father, and the son. They were really nice people. Yeah, they just seemed pretty convincing in the sense that, like, they seemed sincere in what they were saying.
In a private moment, the mother starts talking to 7-year-old Paul.
She talked to me as a child and told me that the Christmas tree was bad and just pretty much all of their teachings around Christmas, which is just a pagan holiday, and they're not allowed to celebrate really any pagan holiday. So in that time, as a 6 or 7-year-old, I was pretty impressionable. I saw that this family was happy and going to church, like, there were kids around my age, and, like, all these people were just overall happy, or at least that's what they seemed to be. So I took it upon myself to cancel Christmas. I forced my parents to take down the tree and to cancel Christmas because I was told that that was bad, and I really wanted to start going to church, and I don't know why I was listened to, but it worked.
Paul and his family had just moved to the outskirts of Boston, and they were still finding their feet in the community. His mom had decided to relocate the family to an area with a good reputation for education, so that the kids would be more likely to go to college when they grew up. This was really important to her, because neither she nor Paul's dad had been to university. But that day, when the happy-looking family showed up at their door, that day was a turning point.
So pretty much from there, it was just like a snowball effect. We just went to church, and church is pretty tasking. So it's Tuesday, Thursday, and Sundays. And then on Saturdays, you have to go and preach, knocking on doors.
Paul was really young, but he decided to absorb himself in being a Jehovah's Witness. And it wasn't long before his mum did too.
So I think she wanted a bit more in terms of religion. She saw that we had just moved to Massachusetts. So I think it was a way to, like, kind of also find roots where you were living and find a network. I remember my parents weren't married at that point, but in order for her to be a full member of the Jehovah's Witness congregation, she had to get married because in the eyes of that religion, you're effectively leading a sinful life if you aren't married to your partner. So they got married, and then shortly thereafter, she got baptized.
Baptism is an important step in becoming a Jehovah's Witness. But unlike other Christian denominations, they don't perform baptisms at birth. Instead, you do a very public and very self-aware baptism, normally as an adult, in front of an auditorium of believers. Before the ceremony even begins, you need to sit a test, and then you have to prove your sincerity through a form of analysis that's done by the church elders in your congregation.
As a child, you really think in binaries, right? In either good or bad. So you just want to excel at whatever is expected of you. So in that case, that was just going to church and indoctrinating yourself in that religion.
Paul was smart for his age, and his mum had instilled in him a sense of pride in achievement. So he set himself the goal of being the youngest person in his congregation to pass the test and be baptized.
I knew I had to cross that bridge at some point. So I was like, why not be the youngest? And that way, like, I feel like everyone would be proud of me. So at 12, I was the youngest person in our congregation to be baptized. I was like, well, this is great. Like, it's a getting a star achievement, you know?
For most of his childhood, Paul had been certain he was doing the right thing. In fact, his whole Jehovah's Witness lifestyle that he and his mother had adopted was born out of his reaction to that first family that had come knocking at his door when he was 7. But as he approached puberty, the seed of doubt was entering Paul's mind. And ironically, this started happening around the time that he was accelerating his own baptism.
I was pretty good at accepting things as fact and like just doing what was expected of me. But then once I started to be able to use my own reasoning, I just started questioning things. Even at 12, doubt was already in my mind. I already had doubt.
You see, Jehovah's Witnesses have very strict rules. Like, for example, you need to do a certain number of hours of door knocking. In fact, you even need to keep a strict timesheet to prove that you're meeting your quota. But there was one rule that affected Paul the most. You can't be friends with people outside of the religion, which made going to the local school pretty difficult.
My schoolmates and all that stuff, I just could not hang out with them. I wasn't allowed to. So it was a pretty lonely upbringing in that sense, when you only have like one or two friends that you can kind of rely on as friends. And I think that was the first push away. It was just the fact that like I was missing out on so much.
For example, Paul couldn't go to birthday parties or Christmas celebrations, especially at school. When something like that was on, he'd have to sit by himself in the library, sometimes for the whole day.
I just started feeling really alone, and it was just hard for me to understand that I couldn't hang out with people that were actually really great people just because they weren't in the church. It was really hard for me to only be around people that didn't challenge you, and that's the big key in being a Jehovah's Witness. You can't really be around people that challenge or question or make you think beyond what you're told is right and wrong. That was the first part. The second part was me accepting being gay and the fact that I was around 15, and you get married really early in the church. You get married around 18, 19, 20 because you're not allowed to have a partner or any sexual relations or anything with anyone until you are married.
Apparently, it's pretty common for young Jehovah's Witnesses to get trapped in unhappy, premature marriages. And because divorce isn't an option in the church, their misery lasts a lifetime.
Like, I just saw all of this and I'm like, oh my God, is that where my life is heading? Is like, am I going to have to hide the fact that I'm gay and get married to a female and live this whole double life? Or this whole fake life that I don't want to live and I'm uncomfortable living. And like, it crossed my mind for quite a long time. I was just like, well, I can do it. I can do it. Then around 15 or 16, I was like, I definitely can't do it. At that point, I really started fully rebelling against my parents. But my mom was a bit omniscient in the sense that like, it was pretty much either you live in this house under my rules or you don't live here at all. And her rules were not having friends outside of the religion and staying true to like my pact when I got baptized at 12. And that was just really too hard for me because I just had too many questions and none of my questions were ever being answered. And that caused quite a lot of problems with her and with the religion as well.
Although he wasn't ready to come out to his family yet, Paul knew he no longer felt any connection whatsoever to the Jehovah's Witnesses and their beliefs. But losing faith and leaving the church are two very different things.
So once you're baptized, like, that's it. You've signed the contract pretty much, and it's pretty hard to get out of the religion, unscathed at least. When you get indoctrinated in the religion, it's very public, and when you get kicked out of the religion, it's very public. So to leave the church isn't very easy, or at least it is quasi-easy. It's just really shameful. So unless you're willing to put yourself in, like, put your name out there and have people talk about you and all that stuff, it's not a very good process.
At 18, when Paul moved away for university, he ended up just completely turning his back on the religion. It was easier than formally leaving, which involves facing a group of church elders, kind of like a tribunal, and reciting all your sins for their judgment.
Whenever I would come home for the breaks, they would always come to my house and talk to me and be like, you need to come and you need to tell us your sins. And then they'd decide whether you are disfellowshipped. Once you're disfellowshipped, everyone has to cut ties with you, which is the hardest bit of being a Jehovah's Witness, in my opinion, is the fact that even your family has turned their back on you. And I didn't want that. Like, and I also don't think I should be going in for public flogging. So I refused to go in, and they were just, the church elders continually kept coming to my house and asking me to come in. And I told them that they could effectively do whatever they want. I'm just not going to go into the church to be publicly humiliated in front of everyone. At 19, I came out to my mom. Funny enough, I came out as bisexual because I thought it was the easiest thing to come out as, even though I am gay. And then shortly thereafter, I was just like, no, I'm definitely gay. And she had a hard time. The first thing she did was cry. The second thing she did was open the Bible as she was yelling at me and read Bible passages to me. And it was hard. It was really emotional. So I kind of let her stew on that. I was like, you know what? Like, I'm an adult. If you want to have a relationship with me, you can. I would love to have a relationship with you. If you don't, because I am gay, I really can't hide this from you anymore. My dad, I knew he would be fine with it. He was more so upset just because I told him everything in life. He was more so upset that I didn't tell him, that I didn't trust him enough to tell him, but given the circumstances, how could I?
But over time, things eased.
So my mom, with time, she's gotten better. Now she's actually great in the sense that, she looks for adoption agencies for me to adopt when I'm ready to adopt, to have children, which is a big deal. It's a big deal when your parent is that supportive, when they want you to have a family and they want you to be happy in life, that they're willing to help you along with it. Because she's always been there for us. She's always made sure that we were her priority. It was hard in that sense because the church was telling her one thing and she felt another thing when it came to her children.
All these twists and turns in Paul's life came back to one day. One memory he just can't shake.
That moment is just burned in my mind from when they knocked on the door and told me that the Christmas tree was bad and told me that Christmas was bad. And I'm happy that I did what I thought was right, but I also regret being taken advantage of in that situation because I really do feel like I was taken advantage of. I was very heavily influenced. I'm more or less brainwashed in that sense, and I really regret it just because I really did. I was just gung-ho about that religion until I was 13. So I was just such a little crusader, such a scary child. but yeah, it's one of those things that it's burned in my mind and I really regret that moment.
Today, things are much better between Paul and his mom.
With my current boyfriend, who is Australian, they just recently met him. They really like him. Yeah, it's great. They communicate with him, which is a big deal to me as well. It's the first time that that's ever happened.
Living in Sydney now, Paul feels far away from the grips of the Jehovah's Witnesses back in Massachusetts. He's technically still a member of the church, but he feels distant enough from that time in his life and has moved on. He even ticked no religion in the Australian census last week.
That story was by Selena Shannon. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden. At 22, Bianca Sugarova was an actress and activist who became something of a public figure in Georgia after she appeared in a short film about the life of a transgender woman. Not Georgia, the state in the US, Georgia, the tiny country between Russia and Turkey. For a while, she appeared in Georgian TV shows. She modeled and was pretty much a star of the Georgian trans community, which, publicly at least, was very, very small. This next piece is about Bianca, told by her friend and Sydney-based painter, Milano Suhatsu.
In this video, you can hear Bianca Sugarova walking through her village in Georgia. It's from a website called Coda Story. She's walking down a sludgy path with goats and animals by her side. The town looks pretty derelict. Damaged houses and beaten up cars are scattered all across the muddy road. In contrast to her surroundings, Bianca moves gracefully in a cream corset and high heels, like a Barbie doll in a slum. She pauses and stares into the camera. This is her story. It's also the story of a small movement in Georgia, told through her friend Milano.
She started to understand that she was not who she was born at 12, and already started to wear dresses in this village. From the beginning, she was saying that villagian people, they took her like, oh, it's a kid, that will go away. But then she grew up, and she understood that she doesn't want it to hide anything, because she knew that it was natural. She knew that that was her.
A few months ago, I started researching the story of this woman. I found out about Bianca through an artist named Milano Sohadza, who lives in Sydney. She had collaborated with Bianca and knew her well. Milano is also from Georgia. It's a country she has a complex relationship with. Like much of the rest of the world, Georgia is still adjusting to trans visibility. Obviously, not everyone in Georgia is transphobic, but many people who are have a lot of support and power, particularly in the church. But when I started talking to Milano, I learned pretty quickly that Georgia has a troubled history altogether. Until the 1990s, it was part of the Soviet Union, and when that all fell apart, the collapse took its toll on the tiny country.
And it took like 20 years for a country to become something. And then because this 20 years, it was pretty stagnant, we saw everything through films or through TV, and then you have this dream of, oh, this looks so colorful, so beautiful, we want that. But in reality, to achieve that takes a long, 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 painful time. And at the time, artists, like a lot of people left Georgia because there was really minimal way of survive. So anybody that could leave Georgia left Georgia.
Milano was one of those people. She says she left her country because it couldn't support her, and politically she felt very much like an outsider. Since leaving Georgia, she's taken her art all over the world. She's shown it in London, Amsterdam, Geneva. She serves up what she calls radical micro-revolutions, challenging social norms about gender and sexuality. Today, Milano works as an artist in Marrickville, in Sydney. Her paintings are political depictions of the human body, and a lot of them are inspired by Bianca.
In certain moments of my life, I understood that if I wanted to live in a better society, I had to use art as a messenger.
In 2013, between leaving Georgia and coming to Australia, Milano was moving around a lot. But while she was living overseas, something terrible happened back in Tbilisi. It was the event that would first bring Milano and Bianca together. On May 17th, 2013, so 3 years ago, a small group of people held a rally in Tbilisi to protest the country's widespread homophobia. If you're imagining a big protest, think again. Reports estimated only between 12 and 20 people showed up, a tiny group, standing alone in the town square carrying some banners.
People went outside just to say that everybody has a right to exist and everybody has a right to have their own sexuality and we have to be free from the judgments. So there was really peaceful demonstration.
But when the wider public found out about it, things escalated dramatically. Here's the BBC reporting on it.
Thousands of anti-gay protesters attack a van in which gay activists are trying to flee. This was supposed to be a small, peaceful gathering against homophobia, Instead, angry mobs took to the streets in support of homophobia.
The video shows up to 20,000 angry people swarming to attack the small group of anti-homophobia protesters. The activists managed to escape in a yellow van, only a few of them injured, but the message from the public was loud and clear. You don't belong. On the other side of the world, Milana watched these terrible events unfold with shock and horror.
So we were just watching things on internet and calling friends if they were okay because they were there. They've been chased after. It was not only there. Like, people have been chased afterwards. So they knew their names, they knew who were there. So they literally had to hide.
According to a Balkan publication, The Balkanist, only 4 people of the 20,000 were fined during the violence. But out of all this chaos and tragedy, 2 women found each other, Bianca and Milano.
My friend Elena Navariani, she wanted to make a film about transgender people in Georgia and the problem about that around this subject.
After the terrible riot, Milano felt she had to return to Georgia and try to help the situation. She wanted to make a film that would draw attention to the persecution of trans people. It was during the casting of this film that she first met Bianca Sigurova.
We met a lot of trans people that we wanted to cast for our film, but none of them were agree to take part in the project because they were saying that we can't show our face, we can't actually openly talk about ourselves. And Bianca was the one that was like, I'm going to do it.
Taking part in this film was always going to be risky. Being openly trans was a very dangerous move in Georgia. But Milano says that Bianca believed in the cause.
Bianca said, if I'm not going to talk about that, then who will talk about that? She was saying that I'm going to inspire others to not be afraid and to show themselves that we are beautiful and we are part of this society as anybody else. So Bianca was very happy to take part in that film. So we are very happy as well.
The film was called The Gospel of Anna Surma, and it was a controversial story because it showed the daily life of a transgender woman in Georgia. It showed her waking up in the morning, in her home, her relationship with a man. There were some scenes that even showed her naked body. The film was also about the events that led to her tragic, violent death, and while it was fiction, it reflected a common fear for many people in the LGBT community in Georgia. Milano knew there was never going to be an easy way to make a film about trans women in Georgia. But not being trans herself, the process was a huge learning experience. While shooting The Gospel of Anna Surma, Milano began to understand Bianca and piece together her life. Bianca endured frequent beatings, abuse in the street, but she was mostly very lonely.
She had a lot of friends, but she was lonely because Bianca was rejected from the family. Her mother didn't want to see her. Her father didn't recognize her as a person. There was only her grandmother that accepted her because she was saying, oh, she's sick, so I have to take care of my sick grandchild. In the village, she said that nobody helped her because everybody was afraid of the whole village. So she was alone.
Working with Bianca was an eye-opening experience for Milano. It wasn't long before she sort of became Milano's muse. Milano felt a strange connection between Bianca's body and her art. And that connection was that Bianca's body was political.
You know, like when I first saw her naked, because there was one scene when she had to be actually entirely naked. And she had a problem to do that because she could not entirely accept her body because she wanted to have a breast and she wanted to have a female genital. And she was saying that nobody ever saw me naked, even when she would have, you know, sexual connection, she would try to hide it. But anyway, what I wanted to say, when I saw her first naked, I understood that the body can talk so much about personality and about the history in general. So yeah, I'm very much connected with her, with that fascination of the body. We finished the film and we showed it in Georgia as well. It was shown in some cinemas. Not all the cinemas accepted that, so it was shown in small cinemas. And after that, she'd been interviewed several times in the TV. And there was other girls that started, also trans girls, that they started to speak about themselves.
It seemed like the film was having an impact, and despite the controversy, it was giving a voice to the LGBT community.
So it was becoming more and more the tension for media to talk about those people. And so the people that had the problem with that was becoming nervous. Bianca had several times some people treating her to death, to stop talking, straightforwardly go into her and strangle her in the corner and say, if you want to be alive, stop it. And that's it.
But sadly, a few months after the film's release, Bianca was found dead in her apartment. The cause of death was a faulty gas leak. Her death was treated by authorities as an accident, but to many in the transgender community, it was believed that she was poisoned and that it was murder, a hate crime, although it could never be proven.
Honestly, my reaction was I just exploded, because she had such a personality that was so strong. You think that whatever she does, it's dangerous, but she will survive because she is so strong. At that time, actually, when such a strong person is going away, you understand how much influence they have on you and on your life as well, and how much you lose yourself as well.
After talking to Milana and doing some research, I found out that gas leak deaths were common in Georgia, according to emergency medical care stats. In 2010, over 1,000 people were poisoned by domestic gas leaks. 13 of those people died. But Milano is part of a group that believes that because these gas deaths happen so often, they're used to cover up murder, in particular, the murder of targeted minorities.
We don't say that, oh, this is how they kill trans or gay or lesbian people. It just happens now, third time, that a third sexually differently oriented person is killed by the gas.
There's no proof the gas leak deaths are deliberate, but the courts that are put in charge of investigating them are slow and negligent, according to Milano. The LGBT community in Georgia believe they have cause for suspicion. Bianca died less than 18 months after her film premiered, so when Milano looks back on her film, she wonders, did her work contribute to her death?
Because in the film she's dying, and then, like, she's killed, and then in reality she's killed as well. Like, we don't know how to react still on that. You still fear of what have you done, actually? Like, did you provoke that? You know, like, there can be so many questions. This feeling is still there. This pain is still there. After her death, she was brought back to her village to bury in her family graveyard. And my friends went there. I could not go there because I was in Australia, and I thought that if I will fly, I'll just die on the way. So my friends that were in Georgia, they were organizing her burial. And so they brought her body in the village, and they thought that nobody will come because everybody hated her. But what happened is that everybody in the village came and cried there. And my friends, they said that, well, she changed their hearts. It's sadly that after her death, they embraced her, but they understood that she meant a lot to them. The whole village was there. So I'm very, very proud of her.
Since Bianca's death, Milana has begun working through her pain by painting her muse in her studio in Sydney. Today, she's working on a special project far from the persecution and troubles in Georgia. She's painting a series of women in angelic forms, powerful, radiant women.
In certain moment of my life, I understood that art itself can provoke a change in society. There's no room for sense.
That story was by Sydney producer Andre Shannon. All of our stories today were kind of about not knowing someone's history and the importance of understanding someone's story or where they've come from. When I first met my Sydney-based co-host, Pip Rasmussen, she said that from hearing my voice on All the Best, I sounded like, and I quote, a shrimp cocktail kind of guy. I still don't know what that means, but I think about it probably most days. Anyway, it saddens me to say that Pip is moving on from her role as Sydney-based presenter of All the Best. Pip, we're going to miss you. All the Best is broadcast from FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and Triple R in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beck Fari is our SYN Production Manager. My co-host is Pip Rasmussen and I'm Michael Bryden. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can also find our archive at allthebestradio.com and while you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.